Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I have a kind of a romance with the whole idea of government and public service. So at the same time that I knew I was going into a madhouse, I also, it was a matter of pride that perhaps I could be helpful and there was nothing more useful I could do with my life.
That's New York Lieutenant Governor Richard Ravitch with a little This American Life bed music there in the background. He was featured on This American Life. And yes, Ira Glass braved the madhouse of Albany and returned to tell the tale. Don't worry if you missed it. WNYC FM is offering an encore presentation of the episode tonight at 8 because it was such a hit in New York State. I think you'll enjoy the This American Life take on this particular subject close to home. And Ira Glass and the Lieutenant Governor join me now. Welcome back to the show, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Ira, I just have to ask, why Albany? We talk about the budget and the mayhem all the time, but you have a national audience and, you know, state political dysfunction doesn't necessarily seem like the This American Life kind of thing, unless it's the dysfunction that makes it so, because I think you're into all kinds of dysfunction. But what made this a story for This American Life?
I mean, honestly, the Lieutenant Governor has some very good press people, and one of them was very familiar with our show and had heard the Lieutenant Governor going around saying that his own views of what government can do for us were being challenged by our current economic crisis. And, you know, I think the Lieutenant Governor will tell you, you know, he got into politics, he got interested in politics anyway as a liberal. And what was going on now was really making him question what can government do, given the amount of money we have and our willingness to tax and all of that. And the thought that this person was going through this radical change this so late in his career and so late in looking at and being a participant in politics seemed like a very, very interesting story that the Lieutenant Governor was somebody who was a witness to something very intimately in a number of stages of New York history. And the thought that he would be reevaluating, that seemed like it would give us a window into the current crisis. And then also he just seemed like an interesting guy to talk to.
And before we bring Lieutenant Governor Ravitch in, Ira, you have a clip that's actually an outtake that didn't make it onto the show with Mr. Ravitch's story of the fiscal crisis in the 1970s, including a vivid part of that story. Do you want to set this up for us?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm going to have to talk through this as three little pieces of tape. And what this is that, you know, part of what we tried to establish in our story for our national audience is, who is this guy? And the thing that Dick Ravitch is best known for in New York is that he is part of the team that saved New York City from bankruptcy in 1975. And this involved completely overhauling the way the city did its finances. And Ravitch was the team member who invented the method that the city used to raise the short-term cash that it needed. But Ravitch, fascinatingly, was also the one who was called into action on this day, October 16th, 1975, which was the day, the actual day, that New York City came closest to actual financial collapse.
I mean, this is a very long story. I have notes on all this stuff. It's for a book I'll never write.
On October 16, 1975, the teachers' union basically declared that it would not purchase $150 million in these special government bonds that were being sold to raise money for the city. And with the city so close to insolvency, basically it just seemed too risky to the union and its pensioners. And so Ravitch knew that without this $150 million, it would be the end of the line. That would throw the city into bankruptcy the next day. And he could not stop thinking about it. He went to bed early. He was depressed.
About 10 o'clock at night, phone rings. It's Governor Carey. He says, please come to my office. I got dressed, I went down to his office, and he was in white tie and tails, and he said, you got to call Shanker and get him to change his mind.
Now, Shanker was Albert Shanker, who was the head of the teachers union that, you know, was not going to be buying these bonds. And can I just say, when Ravitch tells this story, at this point, the story takes this crazy detour, like a lot of Ravitch stories involving people that most of us have only read about in books. In this case, some legendary 1960s civil rights figures. And the whole point of the detour is to say he knew Shanker through those guys. And in fact, he knew Shanker well. And so he knew Shanker.
So I met Al in his apartment at 11:30 at night. I said to Al I understood his reluctance, that I respected his dilemma. On the other hand, this is one of those unique circumstances in life where the consequences of going into bankruptcy was so disastrous that you had to take some risks. So he didn't make up his mind. He said, I'll call you at home first thing in the morning. So I'm at home, and I'm listening to the radio, showering, and I've been up all night. And all of a sudden, they interrupt. They said, we're interrupting this program to announce that the city of New York's going into bankruptcy today. I never heard from Shanker.
So finally, hours later, Shanker calls. He wants a private meeting. He wants it away from the press. They try to figure out where can they do this. And so Shanker and the governor, some others, they meet Shanker at Ravitch's apartment. And the beds aren't made. There's really nothing to eat. Ravitch has some old matzah that he puts out, and that's what they've got. So they're dripping crumbs around the apartment. Finally, they convince Shanker that really Shanker's back is against the wall. All their backs are against the wall. And yes, these bonds are risky, but if New York defaults, all the city's contracts will become invalid, including the teachers' union contract, which will be awful for Shanker and his union as well, right? And so Shanker reluctantly buys the bonds. New York City is saved.
That is some story and some piece of New York history. Ira Glass walking us through a few clips, actually outtakes from his This American Life Albany special. We also have Lieutenant Governor Richard Ravitch with us. And Lieutenant Governor, when you look back at that, by the way, that was on a day in October. Did I get that right?
That's correct.
You were eating matzah in October?
Well, I happen to like it, not just for religious reasons.
Better than rice cakes, I guess. So is there any parallel to that moment, either just past or possibly coming to New York State in the current crisis?
That, as I described on Ira's show, is one of the problems. There is no triggering event that grabs the media's attention, the public's attention, that has such dire consequences. This is rather a slow strangulation, and in many ways, therefore, much more difficult to deal with. Economic paradigm has changed in this country and in this state, and the political paradigm is changing far too slowly.
There's this reputation that the 70s fiscal crisis has, and I guess that story is a part of it, in which, however reluctantly, the necessary parties stepped up together and made the necessary sacrifices, that there was some sense of shared sacrifice ultimately on the part of the unions, as in that story, on the part of politicians, on the part of ordinary citizens,
and banks.
What role did banks play?
Well, they had underwritten all of the city paper that was in danger of going into default. They owned a lot of it. They had to be willing to participate in providing loans to enable New York City to go through the transition period until it had a gap balanced budget and until it had restored a sensible accounting system, which, by the way, the city has without a break continued to do every year since then.
And so is this crisis just not as bad because we've never hit that day where we're on the verge of bankruptcy?
It's more serious because there isn't an event that causes people to change their behavior. Nobody's behavior has changed. The banks have continued to propose the same kinds of wacky borrowings that got us into trouble in the first place. The unions haven't yet recognized how different the world's going to be in the future, and the politicians are still trying to find short-term palliatives to a fundamental shift in our economy, which is that our state expenditures, are rising a lot faster than our state revenues.
Ira, what were you trying to say there?
I was going to say, like, one of the things that the lieutenant governor points out in our story is one of the big differences is a state can't go bankrupt. A city can go bankrupt. And because of the way the state's finances are organized and the way the bankruptcy law works, the state isn't facing this imminent crisis with a deadline in the way that the city did.
If I understood Ira correctly, Mr. Ravitch, he said earlier that you've gone through a sort of late life political transformation around this crisis. Would you describe it that way?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a political transformation, frankly. I think what I described to Ira was that the motivation for public service was that, like so many other people, that it was to make the world a fairer place, to have more equity in this society, to help people who can't help themselves. That was the motivation to be interested in public service. And that conflicts with the economic reality, the inadequacy of public resources at this point in time to address those problems in the way they would like to be addressed. But the consequences of ignoring them are worse. So it is why the state of New York, every state in this union, the United States of America, and indeed every democracy around the world, is in the process of changing the way they do things. And people have to recognize that there will not be the growth in public benefits that have been historical and rising over these last years, that there has to be a change.
Now, the piece on This American Life is titled Mr. Fix-It, because you were Mr. Fix-It in the 1970s and you're trying to be Mr. Fix-It again today. You were Mr. Fix-It for the MTA in the 1980s. But the fact that you allow in your plan currently for some new borrowing to balance the budget in exchange for tighter controls on spending and the elimination of one-shot fixes has become a huge stumbling point. And in fact, here's a clip from the show from the Albany Reporter's annual musical review. This is reporter Jay Gallagher playing you, Richard Ravitch.
Back in the 70s, I cooked up remedies so New York did not kick the bucket. My plan was clever, a brilliant endeavor, and it is the plan that you now should follow. You haven't tried it, but I have decided to borrow.
So we learned from that clip that Jay Gallagher can't sing. Other than that, Ira, why did you include that in the show?
Well, it just shows how the plan got distorted by editorial writers and by the political operatives up in Albany. The lieutenant governor wasn't saying he liked the idea of borrowing. He was just saying if you have to borrow, this would be the only acceptable way, would be to tie it to these fiscal controls. And basically the plan, very thoughtful, complicated plan that was very, very similar in a number of ways to the plan that saved New York City in the 70s, this plan got reduced to one word in the kind of easy politics of you know, soundbite politics, and it got reduced to borrowing, which actually it wasn't about borrowing.
Lieutenant Governor, are you frustrated with that too?
Yes, I am. The important parts of the plan were a requirement that the state go to gap budgeting, that the state be required over a period of time to go to a structurally balanced budget, which I did not believe could happen overnight. I thought it would take 5 years. And the creation of an independent fiscal monitor, not a control board, because I didn't suggest this board had any power whatsoever. It merely had to be the independent authenticator of whether or not the state had a balanced budget or not. Because it wouldn't be credible if the very people who enacted the budget were the ones to make the judgment as to whether it was truly balanced or not. That was the key. The borrowing was merely a recognition of the fact, and we'll have to wait to March 31st to find out how much actual borrowing will have been done in this fiscal year, but it was a recognition of the fact that it was only through bond covenants that you could enforce the obligations that hopefully had been contained, would have been contained in legislation that would have required structurally balanced budgets within 5 years.
But what do you say to all the critics who say, well, borrowing is one of the biggest things that got us into this mess in the first place, so maybe we just have to steel ourselves for additional pain this year so that we don't get further into debt?
Brian, I have supported every one of the cuts and every one of the revenue measures that the governor has proposed. Whether that would get us to balance budget without borrowing remains to be seen by the end of the year. And if we could do it by cuts and taxes, that's a terrific result. I made it very clear in the plan that I submitted and in my presentation to the public and to the legislators of the plan that borrowing to deal with operating deficits was never a good idea. That's why the heart of the plan is not borrowing, as Ira quite properly and fairly put out in his broadcast, but rather it's the elements of budget balance, an independent fiscal monitor, and a requirement that in 5 years the state have a structurally balanced budget. That and is that the recurring revenues match the recurring expenditures, because what we're going through now is not sustainable.
And perhaps most surprisingly, once your plan came out, the non-supporters included Governor David Patterson, and this clip again from the This American Life, Mr. Fix-It Albany segment.
And what happened to the lieutenant governor in his first year is what happens to all of us in Albany. The ceiling became the floor, because on planet Albany, there is no gravity and light bends right around the Capitol. So rather than people understanding that this was a way to control borrowing, the legislature viewed it as a ticket for $2 billion.
So, Ira, you wanted to ask the Lieutenant Governor a follow-up question about this?
I was just wondering, from the Lieutenant Governor's point of view, there were two things in your plan that the governor wasn't so keen on, and one was the borrowing. The governor, at the time that you were working up your plan, the governor had already expressed his intention to try to balance the budget without borrowing. And the other is a measure that would it's fairly technical, but would give the legislature more power to write the language of the budget. And that's something they don't have right now. The governor doesn't want them to have that. So there were two things in there that the governor wasn't going to be so keen on. And in retrospect, do you feel like you didn't have enough of in the plan to get buy-in from the governor? Do you know, was that a tactical mistake that you didn't get the governor's buy-in by having those two things in there?
No, look, I respect David Patterson's right and ability to make his own judgment about the merits of these things. I think, number one, Ira, in all candor, there was one inaccuracy. The Assembly was not in favor of my plan just because of the borrowing. That is not true. They indicated very strong support for all the disciplinary measures that I mentioned, that I recommended. So it was not the legislature in opposing everything except the borrowing. That's not true.
Well, the only reason why I said that was because in the language that they put forward, they didn't put in the strict controls and the control board, but they did have the borrowing.
It would take a long time to explain, but
okay.
If you're referring to the first draft that they did, there was the real issue, Ira, is that I believe the Assembly, based on months of conversation with the Speaker and over 100 of the members of the Assembly, that they would have bought most of what my recommendation was. I think as to the issue you raise about the appropriation, the language and appropriation bills, that's a very esoteric issue. The governor has an absolute right to disagree with it. That was my view. But that was not a critical part of the discipline that I proposed as a way of preventing the catastrophe that we're heading towards.
So
And therefore, that's a very complicated side issue. And I understand why the governor would not want to support anything that diminished executive power. But the governor also, I don't think, supported the idea of an independent fiscal monitor, because the last cut of the legislation that was drafted by his staff left that out in its entirety.
Did you want to go one more round there, Ira? Or you
I was just going to say, I mean, do you feel like in retrospect, having these things in that kept the governor from having buy-in with the plan?
No,
like it was a mistake? No,
I do not. I mean, you know, it's as I said, people can honestly disagree, and I'm not sure I understand all the reasons why this didn't get more support, but I have such respect for the process that I think those are questions you ought to ask the Speaker and his staff and members of the legislature. When Senator Krueger was quoted as saying the Senate had a principled position against borrowing, that was utter nonsense, because at the very time she was saying that, the Senate Democrats were vigorously pushing a proposal to borrow against tobacco revenues that would not start coming in until 2019, and she favored that.
So before you both go, Ira, I guess the overarching question on your show is if our political system is capable of handling this level of fiscal crisis. What's the verdict?
I mean, from what I'm seeing no. I feel like the lieutenant governor really schooled me in this. I mean, he was saying, you know, if you look at what people have to do to get elected, they have to bring home stuff for their districts, and rightly so, and they don't want to raise taxes, and so having to do exactly the opposite, which is what you'd have to do to get the crisis under control, it just goes against everything in their DNA, and they're just having a really hard time of it.
Well, we will have to leave it there.
May I make one more fast comment?
Yes,
Brian?
Sir.
I believe it or not, I'm still an optimist, and this kind of fundamental change doesn't happen quickly in a democracy, but it will happen. And as every state's problems get more and more acute, and as the federal government recognizes that it cannot use its printing press in an unlimited fashion, we will end up at some point in time with this kind of fiscal discipline put into place in our states and in our country. And how you balance that against continuing to provide the essentials for the poor people, for people who can't help themselves, is the great dilemma that democracy will resolve in the next years.
Indeed. By the way, you wouldn't be lieutenant governor if Elliot Spitzer didn't have a scandal. And if Elliot Spitzer didn't have a scandal, he wouldn't be starting a new life as a talk show host on CNN. Will you be a guest on that show?
I have no idea. I can't imagine why I wouldn't if he asked me.
Okay. Willing to go on CNN with Elliot Spitzer, the Lieutenant Governor of New York, Richard Ravitch, and Ira Glass, host of This American Life, heard Saturdays at 11 a.m. on AM 820, Saturdays at 9 p.m., and Sundays at 7 p.m. on 93.9 FM, with a special encore presentation of this week's show about Albany tonight at 8 on 93.9 FM. Of course, you can also hear it at WNYC.org. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, Dahlia Lithwick from Slate on Elena Kagan's inbox and the Supreme Court decisions that came down today. Stay tuned.